President Kennedy died.
I'm not a crook.
Hello, and welcome to Journalism 2050 from the Tal Center for Digital Journalism at Columbia University and Columbia Journalism Review. I'm Heather Chaplin. I'm the founding director of journalism and design at the New School.
Hi, yes, I'm Emily Bell. I'm the director of the Tal Center for Digital Journalism, which you've just mentioned. How are you, Heather?
I'm not too bad. I'm very excited today. And I was actually thinking about how everyone starts their podcast by saying how excited they are to have the guests, but
We are excited today.
I have witnesses who could tell you, like, what happened to my face when I saw your book. So I am really genuinely excited to introduce Boston University Professor Quinn Slobodian, I hope I got that right, and tech writer and the founder of Logic Magazine, Ben Tarnoff. They are the authors of the new book, Muskism, A Guide to the Perplexed, great title, guys, which suggests that Elon Musk is not so much a glitch in the system as the system itself. To give you a little teaser, they say, Muskism sells itself as the future, but entrenches age-old hierarchies. It offers autonomy for some and exclusions for others. It's pro-natalist, but anti-immigrant, futurist, but reactionary. It speaks of humanity, but warns of empathy. So welcome, guys, and thank you so much for coming.
No problem. Happy to be here.
Thanks so much for having us.
Seriously, just the copy on the flap in the jacket. I read it out loud to my husband and simply said, "And there you have it, ladies and gentlemen."
Like, yeah.
you don't even need to buy it.
Just read it in the bookstore.
Seriously, your flap copy is too good. But seriously, you really are summing something up that felt like was waiting for a name. So I'm super excited to talk to you. I want to first just give a little bit of context. So this is a podcast that is where Emily and I have been trying to look at, as the name tells you, the future of journalism in a somewhat long-term way. But as anybody who's been thinking about the future of journalism for some time, as both Emily and I have, will tell you, the question, how do we save journalism, doesn't really feel like the right question anymore, that it increasingly feels like, how do we make sure that news and information is circulating and a watchdog function is being fulfilled in the new way that America and the world is being organized? What we're living through now is obviously not the liberal democracy imagined in the 1700s. So we want your help trying to understand what is this new system that we're finding ourselves living in. And I suspect Muskism is a great phrase and a way of understanding it. So first, tell us what Muskism is.
Well, in the introduction to the book, we offer kind of a one-line capsule summary of Muskism, and we describe it as the promise of sovereignty through technology. So it's our argument that we try to elaborate throughout the book that Musk is not really in the business of selling cars, rockets, or satellites, so much as that he is selling a promise that both individuals and nation states can, in an increasingly unstable world, fortify their self-reliance by plugging into his infrastructures. But of course, in doing so, they deepen their dependency on him and his infrastructures.
Yeah, and the way that we went about it was really analogous self-consciously to the way that scholars have talked about Fordism. So people have made the kind of obvious and superficial comparison to Musk and between Musk and Ford in the past. Both build cars. Both are right-wingers, basically. Both have antagonism towards finance in certain ways. But the way that especially social scientists, particularly related to something called the French Regulation School in the 1970s, thought about Fordism was to ask not only how does the factory work, but what kind of a social world is required outside of the factory to make the factory possible?
Yeah, so are you paying your workers enough that they can buy the cars that are coming off the assembly line?
At the basic level, exactly. So there's a mass production plus mass consumption angle. But then beyond that, even things like the nuclear family or the male breadwinner model, the idea of intergenerational upward mobility, eventually even the national space of the welfare state, these all become kind of essential components of something called Fordism. So there is a social contract at the heart of Fordism, and the thing that really was kept presenting itself as kind of a riddle for Ben and I was, what would the analog be in Muskism? You know, what is the social contract? What is the equivalent of the living wage, intergenerational upward mobility, the nuclear family in the era of high digital capitalism that we're living under right now?
And it also made me think a bit of Stafford Beer. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, the system is what it does, which mm-hmm. I'm sure I've got that quote wrong, but essentially that's, I think, when Heather said this is about, it's so good that you found a word for it, because mm-hmm. I think what we're looking at is something that we don't quite have. We know what it is, but we don't quite have words for it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This thing you said about the Fordism and the social contract, the Ford workers did earn more.
Yep.
What do we get from Muskism besides an illusory promise that's actually not in our best interest?
Yeah, it's a good question, and one that we actually struggled with. Because if you think about, you know, Quinn laid out the definition of Fordism as mass production plus mass consumption, you have on the one hand basically a business model, a strategy for making money, and on the other hand a strategy for stabilizing society by essentially securing social peace, by purchasing a degree of social consent. When we look at Musk and Muskism more broadly, it's fairly easy to identify the accumulation strategies, to talk about digital capitalism, to talk about what we describe as state symbiosis, this effort to integrate with the state as a client and a backstop mm-hmm. for private ventures. But when you turn to the question of consent and legitimacy, this is actually where Muskism becomes quite thin. I mean, you can think of Musk's relationship with his reply guys on social media as a kind of fan contract mm-hmm. where you can get this kind of dopamine hit by getting a reply from Musk. Now in the newly transformed X, you can even have your own feeds monetized. So it's a way that he's kind of both algorithmically amplifying the content of his allies and also getting them paid in the process. But the issue here is that the fan contract doesn't scale very mm-hmm. well. So it's actually a weakness in Muskism, but I think one that we're inclined to see kind of symptomatically, actually, that Musk, of course, is not the only member of the American ruling class who's disinterested in the question of consent. Think about Trump. You know, just the absolute lack of attempt to manufacture any consent for the Iranian conflict.
Yeah. Yes, yes. Well, so, I mean, that's so interesting. I think that point about the fan contract obviously doesn't extend to women, generally speaking, I would say, probably.
Not for the most part.
There's not a lot for me and Heather in atting.
Well, I mean, if you're, you know, a blonde influencer on the European far right with very large follower counts.
Two out of three.
And you're willing to preach the remigration of Muslim-born populations, then you might start to get his attention.
No,
but those are the kind of the only, other than, of course, the mothers of his many children. Otherwise, the circle of women of power. Although Gwynne Shotwell is effectively runs SpaceX, so mm-hmm. that is an exception. But yeah, this question of the kind of the consent side is the part that probably dovetails most with the kind of things you all are discussing here in the journalism mm-hmm. space mm-hmm. too.
Well, I actually was wanted before we get into the sort of who's in and who's mm-hmm. out and who gets to decide in this worldview, is the question of who owns the infrastructure mm-hmm. seems so key to the future we're moving into. And I was really struck, you wrote this idea of states ceding their sovereignty to such a degree that it's forced to buy it back in increments, and this massive shift away from this any notion of public good and public ownership. Sort of, this feels like a complete attempt to undo everything that we've done since the Progressive Era and the New Deal. And so I was wondering if you can talk about that a little bit and what it means to have these private people, even separate from the politics of Musk at first, owning this infrastructure and what that means for sovereignty.
Yeah, I mean, I think it helps to place this particular ism that we're throwing into the conversation alongside other isms that people have proposed. So we've already discussed Fordism. But in fact, those French regulation theorists were interested in Fordism at the time they were in the late 60s and early 70s because they saw Fordism actually breaking apart. They thought that, you know, the beginnings of outsourcing, the first recessions in mm-hmm. post-war Europe had caused some doubt about the long-term durability, actually, of this virtuous circle between rising wages and rising standards of living and rising profit margins for the big actors. The period that they inaugurated, really, in the 1970s, as they described it, was post-Fordism. Mm-hmm. And we now know, you know, in retrospect, that consent, this problem was dealt with in different ways in the era of post-Fordism. It wasn't through collective bargaining agreements and kind of lifetime employment, effectively, with large manufacturing firms, but it tended to be instead the securing of mass prosperity through things like asset price inflation. Mm-hmm. So ownership societies become the way that people feel a sense of commitment to the political system. This is, of course, comes along with indebtedness and the ease of acquiring consumer credit, along with an ideology of both customization, you can pick the version of any goods or lifestyle you want, but also then responsibilization. So a sense that if something is going wrong, it's because you yourself have a kind of personal failing. So right. What you're describing is, I think, not entirely novel, right? Like the progressive model has been undone for some time now. And the normal term is neoliberalism for this mm-hmm. period as yep. well. But the thing that struck us as different about what Musk is doing is he doesn't really operate with the classic neoliberal binary of the state and the market, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, from sort of Thatcher through Reagan, through Clinton, up really even into the Obama era, there was this assumption that the state really can't do anything well, so you need right. to put things right. in the hands of mm-hmm. the market. And in fact, that's partially why the biggest boosters of Silicon Valley from the 90s up until very recently were Democrats, mm-hmm. because it was part of a kind of Clintonite neoliberal perspective. What's interesting about the last several years, let's say since 2016 or 17, is that state market binary is sort of blurring. So in fact, whatever Trump is inaugurating is something that is happier with the clear, visible hand of the state mm-hmm. organizing economic affairs. It's becoming something a bit more like a state capitalism
right.
than a neoliberalism. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about mm-hmm. Musk is he is a very active and willing participant in that new synthesis. Mm-hmm. So we wouldn't actually, I think, see Musk as a neoliberal. We certainly wouldn't see him as a libertarian, because he right. actually, and he also isn't just a crony capitalist. He's not just, you know, securing patronage to kind of parasitize the state the way that arguably like Trump's sons are doing, right?
Right.
Left, right, and center. Rather, he's actually building out certain kinds of state capacity at the expense, as Ben introduced at the top, of a kind of new dependency. So that's what was interesting for us, was like this reset of state.
One thing that really... sorry, Heather. I'm just going to cut across you. Having said, I'll just sit here and say nothing, as you knew. That was not going to happen. So one thing that it actually struck me, I spent a lot of my career covering Rupert Murdoch as a media mogul. And one of the things that's very clear if you watch Murdoch is that he's not really about exploiting the free market. He's about exploiting political relationships and existing regulations, particularly where he can have them mm-hmm. molded around his business interests. Mm-hmm. And it felt like you'd identified almost exactly the same mm-hmm. thing. And I was mm-hmm. sort of, okay. You know, but we had that separation, I guess, you know, even in the very recent past of Rupert Murdoch being very close to the Reagans and the Thatchers of this world. You've now got Musk's, that's a closer relationship, and the nature of his infrastructure is, I guess, it is integrated in a way that our communication systems and our systems of war and mm-hmm. our systems of commerce are all now in the same space. Mm-hmm. What shift does that represent in terms of our overall environment that we're operating in? I've written down technical authoritarianism here, which again, I don't sort of feel, I'm not sure it's the right word.
Well, I think here and elsewhere, Musk offers us a useful vantage point on certain broader historical developments. And I think one of the things that people are trying to figure out right now is if neoliberalism is fading, you know, as I think is a point of consensus among people across the political spectrum, or is in crisis or in mutation, or at least the old style of neoliberalism seems to be breaking down, what is taking its place? What is the new ism? And for us, we're not trying to simply throw another one on the pile. It's a very oversaturated space. We want to be mindful of everyone's attention. But we do want to make a case that Musk and Muskism offers something unique in this discussion. And one of the things I think it offers is it illustrates the mechanism by which a new political economic order can emerge through an old one, right? And so I think, again, Musk is a perfect petri dish for this, because what we call the neoliberal era, in which the assumption by policymakers is that the private sector has a monopoly on innovation and dynamism, and if the public sector wants to get anything done, it needs to push as many of its functions as possible to the private sector. This was the logic specifically implemented at the Pentagon during the early years of the War on Terror by Donald Rumsfeld that gave SpaceX its opportunity to scale. This is the opening that Musk takes advantage of and presents himself as the entrepreneurial whiz kid from Silicon Valley who can transform the economics of launch by bringing the agility and the visionary qualities of the tech industry to what was then a kind of moribund and declining aerospace industry. Mm-hmm. And in fact, he succeeds. I mean, SpaceX manages to reduce the cost of putting mass into orbit by more than 90% over the course of 20 years. So he does, you know, in a way, kind of validate that neoliberal assumption mm-hmm. that dynamism of the private sector can be unlocked to the advantage of the public sector. But in doing so, I think spawns something that's not quite neoliberal, mm-hmm. right? The child of that we could not cleanly describe as neoliberal, because what Muskism is ultimately oriented toward is not the hollowing out of the state, but rather the increase of state capacity through private means.
Right.
So if you're the Pentagon and you suddenly have a much cheaper way to saturate space with satellites, that increases your state capacity quite significantly in terms of war fighting. Of course, it increases your dependency on Musk as well, but it can't be cleanly described as a diminution of sovereignty of the kind we would think about in the post-Fordist or neoliberal era.
Do we also think it's a muddying of regulation and accountability?
Yeah, I mean, for me, as someone who is on this neoliberal question, spent some time, about 20 years, thinking about neoliberalism now, I had to ask myself more than once, you know, what is fundamentally different about what we're describing in comparison to the way that Hayek spoke or the way that Milton Friedman spoke? And at a basic political level, and this maybe gets into an important contribution, I think, of the book, is that Musk doesn't think about politics at all in the basic building blocks of liberalism. So for all of their faults, and I have written books documenting them, the neoliberals still did at some level believe in the idea of the individual.
Yeah.
They did still believe in the idea of freedom, mm-hmm. liberties, and actually rights of a certain kind, usually market rights that could overrun human rights and so on. But that was their vernacular, the language of classical liberalism still. What's so striking about Musk, and why I think we feel like it required a kind of a new label, is that he is getting his political concepts from the space of software engineering in particular,
right.
And coding, right, in even more particular. He, as a teenager, writes his first pieces of software, sells his first pieces of software with the programmable personal computer of the Commodore that he gets from a Pretoria shopping mall in the 1980s. And ever since then, the way that he thinks about organizing social relations, social bodies, polities, is thought about first through the metaphor of code and mm-hmm. and the metaphors of, as we all know now, viruses, bugs,
yep.
The need to optimize and cleanse software to make it operate at a smoother and a higher level. None of those things have anything to do with classic ideas of political philosophy, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not about even building hegemony in the sense of persuading enough people that the interest of the powerful is also their own interest so that they become kind of naturalized into a new common sense. That's how, let's say, Gramsci, but in a way all, you know, de Tocqueville, all of the greats of political thinking have assumed society to work. Musk doesn't. He thinks that society is a code base, and that if you redesign it in such a way that only your memes are reproduced and copied throughout it, right. And the corrupted code and the mind viruses that work against your interests are isolated and contained and removed from it, then the social engine will hum along and purr perfectly. So the individual is not actually addressed. Mm-hmm. The individual is always thought about in relation to a kind of a totality. And that is a deeply peculiar way of looking at the world, and a strange and unsettling way of trying to organize the unruliness of civil society as we know it. It's not at all a pluralistic way of understanding society. And yet, as we call the second half of our book Cyborg, it is the only way to understand how he goes about his business from the reckless acquisition of Twitter for $44 billion to now the integration of X into XAI, into SpaceX. And this question that is on every investor's mind, which is, what does a rocket and satellite company have to do with the social media platform, is actually quite explainable if you think about politics in this machine-first way that he does.
Well, I was going to say, you used the word reckless in relation to his purchase of Twitter. And I think we all saw it as reckless.
Sure.
What a crazy
Books were
move.
Written about it, yeah.
Books were written about it. Doesn't look quite so reckless now. Is that just accident?
Well, it's funny because I think one of the reasons I think it looks smarter in retrospect is because he's so thoroughly transformed what Twitter is, and even, I would say more broadly, what our understanding of a social media platform is. So I think by its own terms at the time, it seemed quite strange, and you know, it took basically a legal compulsion for him to finish the acquisition. I think by all accounts he had some ambivalence in actually going through with it. But when you look at how he has completely reconfigured the platform since, in particular turning it into not just a platform that prioritizes and privileges right-wing speech, but I think more broadly, one that is committed to kind of increasing automation of speech through Grok. I mean, because that's really the story now, is that social media for Musk is become a kind of playground for AI, a place where you can train AI, but also a place where you can attempt to market and monetize various AI services by pushing your chatbot into interactions. And you know, when you look at what a company like Meta is doing, it's a similar business strategy. You know, if you go on Instagram or Facebook, like you're constantly being pushed these AI companions. You know, so in a way, I think once again, Musk may have gotten there a little bit earlier than his competitors, but this notion that social media may increasingly be oriented towards interactions with AI avatars rather than other human beings seems likely to consolidate in the future.
I think that's such a powerful way of putting it, not least because if you're a journalist, and particularly if you're a journalist in the 2000s, then Twitter came along and was actually infrastructure for you, particularly actually if you were a local journalist.
Yep.
I mean, we think about it as the big names tweeting all day long, but actually the real value of it was that you could be in a remote part of the country and you could know what your school board was doing, but you could also talk to somebody who's at an environmental conference in Norway and find out.
Yeah.
And it felt like such a violation because it felt as though that was a piece of infrastructure that needed improving.
Right. Yeah.
And it just blew up.
Yeah, I think, I mean, talking about the future of journalism, as you all both are in this podcast, at a broader level, I think it's really relevant because one of the things we want to do in the book is not to make this a kind of everyone just needs to unplug, you know, tech is evil kind of a manifesto. It's not actually a Luddite tract. And it isn't partially because, you know, events move so quickly that sometimes one needs to be reminded of things that happened just in the last 10 years, right? That now, for example, when the fact that Jack Dorsey sat on stage at the Code conference with D. Ray Mickelson with a shirt that said "Stay Woke" hashtag made by Black employees at Twitter. And for him, this was one of the first times that the term woke had entered his own vocabulary, and it meant something, you know, for the Black community for decades and decades, and it was about being mindful, about vigilante white violence and about police brutality. And it helped to spark something that was actually quite extraordinary in this country, right? I mean, social media platforms and Twitter did allow for many of those kind of liberatory energies that had long been promised from the 90s onward. What is interesting that happened in the meantime, though, is that, as you're indicating, the journalistic community became so dependent on Twitter disproportionately. I mean, the joke that it became the kind of assigning editor, right?
Yes. Not a joke.
Right. The fact meant that, you know, you could look at this social media platform, which never was one of the largest ones, right, was always just being heavily used by a small fraction, but a select fraction of cultural elites, political elites, business elites, meant that it was a very kind of vulnerable choke point, right? It offered itself for appropriation and transformation. So In our sort of exuberant embrace of it, We actually ended up exposing ourselves in ways that we perhaps hadn't realized at the time.
Right.
And that, did Musk know that? We have all the transcripts of the chats that went up to the acquisition of Twitter. He didn't seem to be particularly canny in that process. But it is interesting that one person we quote in that moment, not someone who I tend to quote very much, but Curtis Yarvin, at the time of the acquisition, had a very interesting Substack that I still remember, where he said, "I don't think much is important, but I think this is important." Because I think he saw accurately that this was a kind of a bottleneck in the information environment, that if it could be squeezed and even turned off, then the consequences would be really great. And a really concrete example of this that for some reason always sticks in my head is in the course of writing this book, Jared Leto was at a premiere for a film at Grauman's Chinese Theater in Los Angeles, and he had a kind of a staged kung fu fight with an Optimus robot in front of the theater. And it seemed certain that the robot was being remote operated, because actually Musk hasn't figured out how to make autonomous humanoid robots yet. And I wanted to cite it, but then I wanted to be able to put in a footnote, you know, this was actually remote operated. But what happened was, I went on X, because that's where I had seen it, and I searched, and all I saw was reports of the facts that it had happened. Right? And then there would be a TMZ.com, MSN, that would just say, you know, people are talking about the fact that this humanoid robot appeared to fight Jared Leto. But there was no one who either had the assignment to or the resources to figure out whether or not.
Right. No reporting.
Right. No reporting could actually be done.
We barely have enough resources to report on the war in the Gulf.
Yes, exactly. So in this case, all you had was the kind of the ripples of the spectacle, and that was now what we had as an information environment. And that was actually, even though it seems trivial, like a real gut-wrenching moment for me, where I was like, wow, actually one has no means of finding out the truth about this incident. All we're left with is that it happened, therefore the spectacle is the truth.
Again, if you extrapolate that out, that is what we're now seeing with AI. I mean, we look at Grok a lot and how those experiments are, as you say, shaping what that platform is. But I think the way you've just connected that is also, it's a pretty horrible moment to understand that this is a completely different information, not just environment, but economy as well, that is really there to stop accountability or any kind of discussion of accountability or sense-making around that. Maybe that's...
And the LLM model is such that it is self-consuming, right? It's a kind of... it's a kind of Ouroboros model, where the more nonsense that's produced, then the larger the training data will be for the LLM to reproduce said nonsense. And if you've set the weights all the way and done the tutoring of it the way that Musk has with something like Grok, then you are actually able to see a method in what can otherwise seem like compulsive behavior on his part, right? This is one of the things we sort of realized at some point, that when he was posting all the time, staying up all night, you know, like on X hours a day, Twitter hours a day, people were like, well, he's really losing it. Like, Musk is coming undone. And maybe he was, he probably was, but also he was figuring out how to work the algorithm to his advantage. And also, if you think about the internet's truth as just the sum total of what has been said on the internet, then the more you say, the more it aligns with your views. So there actually is a kind of a method in the madness of flooding the zone in this seemingly compulsive way.
Well, that's terrifying. it seems like a good segue into maybe talking a little bit about explicitly about his ethos. You know, he grew up in South Africa. I think you write very eloquently about that. You use this phrase, a mood of mastery. And I thought that really said a lot. You say Muscoism has always been committed to a vigorous defense of hierarchy. Some humans are born to rule, others to be ruled. Class, gender, and race are the structural principles. So tell us what it means. We've sort of talked a bit about the way he's taken over some of the infrastructure and his relationship with the state. Now let's talk about the ethos that he's pumping into our system.
Yeah, well, probably the place to begin would be, you know, what Quinn said a moment ago, the notion of the world as code, which is an assumption that Musk has, I think, is not limited to Musk. You know, a lot of people who fell in love with computers early on, who had this experience of kind of becoming one with the machine through all-night coding sessions and went on to found companies in Silicon Valley, you know, he belongs to a milieu for whom this is, I think, widely the case. But as is often the case with Musk, he can be kind of an indicator species for us, somebody who kind of provides some more radicalized expression of more familiar trends. So in the case of Musk, why that computational frame is useful is because it really inflects how he thinks about what a subhuman is. This notion of segmenting humanity into more and less human is not particular to Musk. Arguably, it's integral to Western civilization from its origin, and it's certainly a feature of far-right politics. For Musk, what's distinctive is using the kind of subhuman, or seeing the subhuman through a computational lens. And the NPC is a good example of that. The NPC, for folks who aren't familiar with the term, this is non-player character, which is a concept from video games where if you are a player character, you will be navigating the gaming environment and interacting with characters who are there to kind of entertain you, to provide you with useful information, but are software, are programs who have defined dialogue trees, you know, limited range of motion. And NPC has at this point for years, been Musk's favorite term of abuse. But it's not just meant in a kind of inflammatory way. I think in our view, it really reveals something quite important about his worldview, which is that some people are real people, very few. Most people are subhuman NPCs who are essentially programmed and programmable. And that means, in turn, that you can engineer social consent if you can find ways to seize the correct choke points of the network and circulate new kinds of code. So it's not just a kind of interpretive frame of, okay, you know, there are all of these fake people walking around. It also gives you a theory of power, a theory of politics, one that in our view is quite inadequate, that in fact backfires, because when Musk tries to do politics, he thinks of it in terms of meme politics, that you find various ways to meme harder in order to reprogram people's worldview so that their behavior better aligns with his own interests, and that when people are behaving in ways contrary to his interest, it's because they have been infected by a woke mind virus, right? The term that is most closely associated with his turn to the right. And these are essentially bad memes, bad memes that have infected people's brains and, you know, have them behave in all sorts of ways that Musk finds strange and illegible. So I think that's kind of the aspect of it to keep in mind. It's both a way of seeing the world in a very frightening way, but also a theory of how to change the world.
And as an ethos, I think, too, it shows how what's happening for him is on the terrain of kind of digital discourse. And it's another way, I think, to see the internet as being a terrain of struggle, really, since the 1990s up to the present, in which the dominance of either the left or the right is not always clear. That there have been moments, in fact, when the left does seem to be using network technologies in ways that are, you know, consonant with its own outcomes, and then other times the right responds. One of the touchstones for us is Donna Haraway's 1985 Cyborg Manifesto, which is perfect for our purposes, or ends up chiming up perfectly with the way we're trying to lay out the problem, because she says, on the one hand, the cyborg is clearly the child of the military-industrial complex, mm-hmm. right? It comes out of the research and development of the Department of Defense. We don't have computers. We don't have the internet in its form unless it's of use to the state and of use to the military. But once it has been, you know, unleashed, and once it has been put into civilian hands, then people make different uses of it, and they actually end up undoing sometimes the categories that they have been given in advance. So the internet and the cyborg for her is the possibility of a scrambling of gender binaries, a scrambling of racial identifications, and that the internet and cyborg technologies are always a place where a fight is happening between the two. It could be, as she calls it, a site for the informatics of domination, but it could also be a site for kind of liberatory forms of collective and experimental self-understanding. And we think that Musk is very aware of this.
Right.
And he deeply, because he believes in a code theory of politics, he's very, very invested in making sure that he's the one who has oversight over it. And he wants to make sure that the emancipatory potential that someone like Haraway saw in technology remains extinguished and unavailable. So we use the term cyborg conservatism mm-hmm. in the book, and draw attention, among other things, to one of the great ironies, which is that one of Musk's favorite ways to describe what he's doing is to reprogramming the matrix, right? It's a term he uses right. more than once before he's entering the government with Doge. He also, of course, regularly refers to taking the red pill. And, you know, anyone who knows anything knows that the Wachowski siblings that mm-hmm. made The Matrix intended these explicitly as allegories of trans identity.
Right.
Right.
Yes.
So
the
idea of The Matrix was not about, aha, I have seen The Matrix, therefore I'm going to reinscribe like traditional binaries of gender identity, for example. It was about being able to think outside them. The last movie they made has Keanu flying around. So this seems to point to both a kind of key feature of his ideology, but also kind of a weakness, right? Because it shows also that they're scared, actually. And they're frightened of the things that expose their vulnerabilities, right? Ben and I were both really impressed by this piece that someone we know named Kevin Baker wrote about Project Maven and its uses. And he points out the fact that it's quite interesting that what is now such an essential part of AI targeting technology for the Department of Defense was also the site of one of the most important mobilizations of tech workers against
Project Maven is the surveillance project, which involves the technology of a number of companies, which has been implemented to target civilians, and it kind of is the industrial attack complex. And do they call it target mm-hmm. generation?
It was originally a contract to Google, but then because of the opposition of the mm-hmm. the employees at Google, it ended up shifting to Palantir. And then just as of this week, as of yesterday, I think actually, it's now been integrated officially into Department of Defense technology as the way to find targets.
Right.
There's an interface. You can see tutorials of it online.
It's so interesting. I remember I sort of said something similar when we were talking to Rushkoff, which is, as I was reading this book and then hearing you talk, so my father was a programmer in an early 1960s programmer at Johns Hopkins. And so when I'm reading this stuff about Musk, I'm like, yeah, my father was saying this stuff in the 1970s. Like, there is nothing, but my father he considered himself a post-scarcity anarchist.
Oh,
you know,
wow.
He was far, far to the left. But my whole childhood was all about the coming of the single human consciousness, which he was saying was this great thing. I thought sounded horrible. And it's just fascinating to me how it's this, you're the reading this and listening to it. Now it's the first time it sort of occurred to me that it's a coder mm-hmm. mentality that has something to do with the bond that happens between the person and the machine, maybe. I don't know. It's just really...
Well, it's kind of one of the things that it's so funny and seems so ham-fisted when Musk or Karp or Teal try to kind of address problems of consent or culture. So I just saw a clip of Musk, you know, on stage at the launch of the TerraFab, or the launch of the initiative to make the TerraFab, so to have their own AI chip manufacturing capacity that Intel will help them with. And he's like, yes, so the future is going to be great. You're going to, like, what if you could go to Saturn on the weekend? and then
I
if you
I
listen
don't know
to
that, that sounds quite nice to me right now. But it's like, never been appealing before, but now.
But it's such like it's such a low energy attempt.
It's
to,
so tired.
Right.
I know.
So you can see that when they if they have the mentality like as the engineers, they have already secured really all of the state. Leverage that they need, yeah. Then the story yeah. they tell to everyone else really just becomes a kind of a footnote that can be sort of figured out between the bathroom and the stage or whatever. So
yeah,
the idea
totally.
Of
it's
Western civilization
tired, right? yeah.
or, you know, yeah, defense of the West, birth rates, just like whatever right. meme sort of wanders through yeah. the timeline.
I really was struck reading this how unimpressed I
yeah.
was with him. I mean,
yes.
I'm impressed with what he's achieved. He's taken you do so nicely these inflection points like 9/11 and mm-hmm. then the green energy. You know, he's brilliant at seizing the opportunities and manifesting his will, but his vision is completely boring and not that imaginative. I feel like there's echoes of it, you know, for decades and decades, if not, I don't know. Some of it reminded me of Germany pre-World War I. You know, like it just feels very...
Well, it's the hack of the Weberian problem of charisma, right? I mean, that's the thing about the coder's mentality is if society is just code, then you don't need charisma, right? You just need to...
Or good ideas.
Well, you just insofar as they're functional and adapted to the task at hand.
Right.
But the traditional ways of like bonding with the population, you know,
yeah.
the way people think about populism, you have the category of the people that many diverse people can sort of project their own interests into, and there can be what like mm-hmm. Laclauan move call a kind of chain of equivalence that emerges in the process of a social movement or even an election campaign. I mean, the way Mamdani operates is, you know, very
right.
classic, right? I mean, you could draw a straight line between the French or the American Revolution to Mamdani's campaign last year. Try to draw a line from anything that was done in the liberal classic period of revolutions and the way Musk operates, you will at some point hit a squiggly line that will go through your father's, you know, laboratory and kick out around here. So it really is, I think, a testament to the radically disruptive quality of computerization on social life.
So but I think Musk used to be more charismatic. Like if you look,
yes.
you know, it may
That's
be
a, great point.
A question of taste, but if you look at, look at videos of his presentations and interviews over the course of his career, I think there are periods in which he could present a quite appealing persona, you know, without offering too functionalist an argument. Hopefully we avoid that in the book. I think that dynamic may track a deeper shift, which is the extent to which he is less and less a consumer-facing entrepreneur. Because if you think about Tesla, the importance of Tesla for Musk has receded relative to SpaceX. SpaceX is kind of the big story for Musk. And even within Tesla, EV sales, you know, they're trying to reposition themselves less as a car company and more of an AI and robotics company.
Right.
So, and again, this isn't specific to Musk. Arguably, Silicon Valley as a whole has undergone this real shift away from consumer tech toward so-called hard tech, where the state in particular is a very important client, but it's really about enterprise now. It's not about kind of individual customers. So I think that's part of it too. I mean, it's kind of what Quinn was alluding to. Once you've done all of the hard work of positioning yourself as the ideal state partner, you don't really have anything left in the tank for the retail crowd because it doesn't matter as much.
And I mean, you've written a lot about the culture of Silicon Valley, right? So Musk is an outsider to some extent to that, even though he's a beneficiary of the dynamics of this and he's code obsessed. I just wondered, what you think about the culture of Silicon Valley now. You know, if we look at this new type of cyber conservatism, which I think may have been there all along. Silicon Valley came out of the defense industry, but as Quinn was just saying, you know, you actually have worker resistance there now in a way that you maybe wouldn't have had 15, 20 years ago. Is it fundamentally changing? I think we're so focused on the Musks and, you know, the Trumps and the top of the pyramid. What's actually happening in the places where all of this thinking and making once took place?
Yes. I mean, I think the answer is yes, it's absolutely fundamentally changing. I mean, I think Silicon Valley, you know, when you think about its inception as a semiconductor manufacturing zone in the post-war period, it, you know, from its very beginning kind of enters a series of technological paradigm shifts, you know, from, you know, to put it very reductively, from the semiconductor era to the personal computing era to the dot-com era to the platform era. We're now in the midst of that next shift, which is the AI era.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the things to keep in mind there are not just the kind of obvious headline figures of the enormous amount of investment that these firms are putting in to this technology, but that qualitatively this is a very different type of paradigm than the one that preceded it. So the platform era was all about being asset light, was about really letting your users do the work. I'm clicking around on Facebook, I'm making data, it turns into targeted advertising. We're all very familiar with this dynamic. It's not that that's disappeared. In fact, that's important because that's generated the cash flow out of which the generative AI boom has, for the most part, been financed. But the business model has now shifted, where now you have a very expensive technology that is very energy intensive, that requires a mass construction of data centers, and also requires clients abroad. So it really matters that you're getting into the Middle Eastern market, the Chinese market, that you're trying to push American technological dependence on your chips, on your LLMs, on your app ecosystems. So that, you know, as you might expect, necessitates a different relationship with the state, right? The state actually becomes a really integral partner in that business strategy. And we've seen that very dramatically under the current Trump administration, where they have been opening up federal land for data center construction, trying to roll back environmental review to speed up data center construction. But even a future Democratic administration would face pressures toward playing that same partner role, because you have the leading faction of American capital. It's basically the whole growth story for the American economy. And they're saying, this is what we need. The state is going to be under enormous pressure to partner with them regardless. So I think sometimes people get a little bit distracted or place perhaps too much emphasis on the ideological component of the Silicon Valley Trump coalition.
Yeah.
And for certain actors within that coalition, there are ideological aspects, no doubt. But I think for most figures, there are just simple material considerations. And on the Trump administration side, I think that probably policymakers of any party would face pressure to partner with these private sector actors, given their prominence and given how integral they are to the American economy.
If you guys have like five more minutes,
sure,
I would love to ask one non-journalism specific question, and then I promise we'll bring it back to what all this means for journalism. Is that acceptable to everybody?
Highly.
It's the relationship between Muskism and the state that I just want to ask a little bit more about, because I really hear what you're saying, that this is not neoliberalism, this is not get rid of the state. But you definitely say in the book that it's an attempt to vassalize the state, which I thought was really interesting. And I do think the power dynamic between the Muskism and the state is important. It's not equal, right? Like it is, you say explicitly that it's the Muskism is attempting to make the state its vassal, who then has to give it money in order to have access to infrastructure. So can you just, and because the state nominally is put there by the people, and Musk is not put there by the people, this power dynamic question feels really central to me. So can you just talk about that a little bit more?
I would say it certainly is an attempt to vassalize the state, but it's not always successful. You know, you could see actually the Doge experiment as one that, that was an illustration of the failure of it. And I think in terms of the balance of power between public and private within the dynamic that we describe as state symbiosis, I think it has to be understood as being continuously renegotiated, where that balance of forces is an outcome of continuous struggle. And actually, you could see an illustration of this with the dispute between Anthropic and the Pentagon.
Right.
You know, nominally, it's about, you know, certain things that Anthropic says it's not willing to do. But more generally, you could look at it as a case where the Pentagon understands that its ability to exercise this core sovereign function of war making is increasingly dependent on a handful of small, very powerful tech firms on the West Coast, and it needs to discipline those companies in order to reestablish more power in that state symbiotic relationship. Now, it's important to note that this is about symbiosis, right? The Pentagon gets something from this exchange. It gets the ability to generate these targeting lists with an extraordinary speed, which lets them speed up their kill chain. So it's not, as Quinn was mentioning before, quite a case of parasitism or crony capitalism. There is something being exchanged, but I think the balance of power between the two has to be continuously fought out.
Yeah, I mean, we actually don't really need to speculate about what this dynamic looks like, right? I mean, one of the cases where it was tested out was with the Trump-Musk feud last year, when Trump threatened to cut all SpaceX contracts, right? And to which Musk responded, okay, the Dragon capsule is hereby decommissioned, which would have meant, you know, as I commented at the time, would meant that the American astronauts would be now stranded on the space station, right? So it was actually a hollow threat. There was no, there is no substitute for SpaceX. But, you know, if need be, I mean, the Artemis mission just happened. That wasn't a SpaceX rocket. If need be, if it really wanted to, could the United States government channel resources to strangle out, expropriate, and transfer technology from Musk's empire into a new one of, let's say, run by Jeff Bezos instead? Absolutely it could. That would be a question of political will. The case that Ben just mentioned with Anthropic, right, remember that Hegseth responded by saying, okay, we now declare Anthropic a supply chain risk. So we're treating it now the same way like ZTE and Huawei were treated. Mm-hmm. And its presence anywhere in sort of state-funded infrastructure is now verboten. It's taboo. Mm-hmm. That was in the courts. It's unclear if that would actually get pushed through. The other Silicon Valley companies, very importantly, signed amicus briefs saying that that is against the principle of the division between public and private power, let alone foreign and domestic producers. But you know, we're seeing there in real time. Like it's not, I think, the subordination of the state to these private actors is, you know, structurally there. But to circle back to the way we started the conversation, the Altmans and the Amadeus and the Musks and the Thiels and the Karps still need to outsource the problem of legitimacy and consent to Washington, D.C. They haven't figured out a way to govern on their own, and they probably wouldn't be able to, based on what we're seeing.
And that enables me to bring in my relevance question to future journalism, or rather, because all of this rolls up into the press and large numbers of journalists actually being part of the same system. So whether your news work is literally part of the same system because it's been ingested by a generative AI company, or whether it's because
your
Larry Ellison,
owned by Bezos.
Yeah, but Bezos or actually Larry Ellison, who now has you know, his Oracle founder, whose wealth is now being used to roll up massive media assets like CBS and Time Warner, Discovery, etc.
Or on the other side, if you're NPR and you've been just bailed out by Microsoft money and directly by Ballmer.
Right, indeed. Yes, exactly. But having had that cut off by the trust. So this kind of the information and the knowledge economy, you know, we're all academics in one way or another here as well. How does press freedom, how does academic freedom, how does the knowledge economy or the independent knowledge economy fit into all of this?
Maybe the question is there a role for the free press and the knowledge economy in this future?
Yes, that's a better. Sorry. No, that's a much better way of putting it.
Point on it.
Yeah, I think we hope so.
I was going to say, can we just say yes?
I mean, from an internal point of view, I would say that no, right? I think from like a doctrinaire Muskist point of view, let's say, then, you know, there is a very particular reason why Peter Thiel was paying people to drop out of university to come work for his companies, right? Yeah. The idea of like highly instrumentalized attitude towards learning and that being only things that are aimed towards new kind of innovations and productivity gains inside of companies, I think, is mother's milk for the kind of tech philosophy that we're describing. There is, of course, the tension there, and this is something that Ben has already mentioned a couple times, the way that someone like Musk is not exactly like ex nihilo, but is actually an exaggerated version of other things, which is that we are all at higher ed institutions at one level or another. And if you've been at them for the last 20 years, you know that idea of redirecting all learning towards practical applicability in frontier technologies is what provosts and deans and presidents have been saying since I've been teaching since 2008. So they are actually only accelerating their, I think, an instrumentalized attitude that is already kind of pervasive. But the idea of a contentious public sphere, or as I mentioned earlier, like a pluralistic understanding of the way civil society should work, in which we actually end up producing better outcomes because of the clash of opposing ideas that then have to find some kind of space of compromise, is, I think, the part that is least computable to the mentality that we're talking about here, right?
Does that mean we get to keep it in his post-human cyborg world? Or?
No. Unfortunately not. Yeah, no, I'd love to say.
We're pretty grim, too. We're not really the people you look
Yeah, how's your how hopeful are you guys? Like,
we didn't put any of it in the book.
No.
I think, so perhaps it's useful for thinking about it, to think about like Musk as a media figure, and how he contrasts with media figures in the past, right? We talked about Murdoch. You could think about William Randolph Hearst.
Yeah.
You know, the kind of how has historically influence been exercised through a media environment? And there's, you know, a lot of cases of this. We could even think of Zuckerberg as a media figure in this respect. I think what Musk is attempting to do, and which something we've been trying to draw people's attention to, because I think it's actually a serious source of risk, is through Grok to create a completely self-enclosed reactionary information ecosystem.
Right.
And through the production of Grokopedia, which is this right-wing clone of Wikipedia that Grok calls upon, uses as a source of truth in answering queries when people ask questions of the chatbot. I think it's important to actually situate that within this broader legacy, because if you think about how people get information, you know, in the good old days, it would have been newspapers, television, radio. In the not so distant future, it would have been search engines, social media platforms. I think the direction of travel is that it's going to be an AI chatbot
funnel,
an AI
funnel.
Interface of some kind. I don't know whether it's exactly going to be a website, but it'll be some screen, and the back end of that will be a large language model. That's going to be, and in fact, as I think we were talking about a moment ago, when you do a Google search, you get Gemini at the top anyway. So even traditional
we're
search
we're moving that way.
Is moving that way. Yeah. I think Musk perceives that direction of travel, and that's part of why Grok is so important, because if you can own that interface, then you own what information people receive through that interface. And that, I think, is actually, for me, one of the more frightening prospects.
Yeah. That literally just gave me very unpleasant shivers down my back.
That's what we're here for.
I was like, that's not the future I'm looking for. So can we conclude with what should we be doing?
Yes, we'd like to end with what could we do differently, maybe.
Well, what do we
do? The funny thing about this book is that we wrote it very quickly. So we started at the time of Doge, really. It was last February that we actually looked at each other and said, okay, let's just turn this into a book. And that was, in retrospect now, I think kind of like the zenith of power, really, for the big tech MAGA kind of fusion or coalition, right? That was the moment in which people were still kind of back-footed by what was going on. people really hadn't caught up to, at all mm-hmm. to generative AI and how that might transform the classroom or mm-hmm. human relationships to one another. So they really had a long runway there. They had 2025 where basically they could do anything, mm-hmm. right? I mean, people just, mobilization hadn't caught up, politicians hadn't caught up. And all they needed to do this kind of enormous build-out of the back end for the generative AI hyperscalers that were needed to help run this stuff was cheap energy, cheap credit, ignorant populations, and cooperative
right.
White House. And they had all four of those things. Those things were flying.
Right, right.
In the last month or two, right, since March, since mm-hmm. the Iran conflict, they've lost at least half of those, right? I mean, they've lost cheap energy.
Strategically, cheap that was credit, not a great move.
You know, yeah. Saudis are not, you know, opening their yeah. wallets anymore because they're worried about what's happening in their own backyard. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, populations have woken up to this, right? So the main statewide data center, AI data center ban, got pushed through a couple of weeks ago. Monterey, Oklahoma City. Mm-hmm. We're just going to see those now line mm-hmm. up like dominoes. In fact, now we're in such a rapid backlash that the Republican and Democratic candidates for the midterm are kind of fighting with each other to figure out who can be more anti-AI.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
So that runway is like actually coming very rapidly to an end. And whether or not it is indeed true that they feel like their dominance is so absolute that they don't need to perform the act of persuasion is something we're going to find out.
I was
going to
say, right? There's a faffa yeah. going on that.
Yeah.
Tune in again next year.
I was going
right.
to say.
See where we're at. 2027.
This time next yep. year, we'll reconvene
sure,
and find out.
That's right. In the Joseph Pulitzer School of AI.
Yeah, we'll be like three animes in skimpy outfits, like dancing for the camera.
Guys, I just have to say, Emily has heard me say this, but. And you can cut this and we're over, but I used to cover video mm-hmm. games.
Okay.
And the thing that got me into video games was this saying from Anthropology, show me the games of your children, I'll show you the next 100 years.
Oh, wow.
And I came out of it with this very freaked out vision of the future based on this personality that I've never found quite the right words to describe. And Emily has accused me of geek profiling when
I have geek profiling.
Because it's this personality who is very capable of handling mass amounts of information, is cognitively very intelligent in a very sort of traditionally masculine way, but really has no capacity for human connection or empathy. And when I got your book, I thought, oh, it was must be that I saw.
Really. I'm glad to have given you a name for that.
Yeah, and so I both was horrified and wanted to thank you because how you describe him is what I feel like I saw in 2005 covering early first-person shooter culture.
Yes.
So
yep.
thank you.
You're welcome.
Donata.
And thank you so much for giving up time
sure.
on your
yeah.
very busy book
awesome.
Tour.
Yeah.
Thanks, and
the book is
New
called
City.
The book is called Muskism. It's available everywhere. Mm-hmm. We're a global brand, as you can tell. So
it's a great book.
I'm fantastically annoyed that you wrote it so quickly as well.
It'll never happen again.
I was going to say, Heather's been writing a book for a while. Me and a co-author have been writing a book for so long that we're now, maybe it could just be a history book.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for this fantastic
Absolutely.
Conversation.
Yeah, thank
Our
you
pleasure.
For your time,
yeah,
really.
For having us.
Super interesting. Good luck with the book. Listeners, buy it. It's good.